Well, good afternoon and welcome to the first Teneo Insights call of 2021. Exactly 1 year ago, we had only the vaguest of understandings of COVID-19. It seemed to be an obscure virus affecting people a long way away, something that would probably sort itself out. Instead, the virus has dominated the last 365 days, affecting the lives of all 7 billion people on the planet. Many are feeling that we're currently at peak bleak. So talking about the future is always a precarious activity, creating endless hostages to fortune. But with mass vaccination programs underway, we can start to think about the light at the end of the tunnel, and we can ask where we're likely to be in another 365 days' time. In the next hour, we'll touch upon some of the big emerging themes and ask key questions to give businesses some sense of what lies ahead. What can President Biden do to change things? After the reality show of Trump, will normal service be restored? Will the economy struggle or will it surge ahead? Or perhaps more likely, will we see a K-shaped recovery where the graph goes both ways with big winners and losers? Climate change is well and truly back on the international agenda, but will COP26 amount to more than hot air? Boris Johnson used it to reveal the UK can still be credible internationally in a post-Brexit world. And what will be the new normal, or perhaps to put it better, the new different? There's so much to talk about, and we have the perfect panel to guide us through it. Dani Minton-Beddoes is the editor-in-chief of The Economist. She'll be explaining why she thinks after the crisis, there is room for much optimism. Tony Danker is the brand new director general of the CBI. He'll be telling us where he thinks we are in the short, medium, and long term. William Hague is a regular on these calls, a former foreign secretary and current Teneo senior advisor. He pointed out 10 months ago how COVID-19 was accelerating trends, and he'll be explaining where that's led and where it's going. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the sidebar of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on this call, apart from Zanny, of course, please hang up now. This isn't intended for outside broadcast or publication. Zanny, let's start with you. It feels like things have been pretty bleak recently, but your latest edition of your magazine is basically saying that you think there are a lot of grounds for optimism. Do you want to start us by talking us through that?
Sure. Hi, everybody. Thanks, Craig. I love your phrase, peak bleak. And usually I'm not the person to be counted on to be the kind of massive optimist in the room, but I think I'm going to counter your peak bleak with some optimism. I'm feeling much more upbeat than I was. And I guess the reasons are twofold. They're basically Joe and the jab. I think that the world is a fundamentally better place for the most divisive and dangerous American president in history, probably, but certainly in living memory to be gone. And Joe Biden brings a palpable sense of normalcy. I mean, just in the last 48 hours, it feels like life is returning to normal, and the kind of the realm of extremes has narrowed. So that's one big thing. And the other is the jab, and the fact that we have so many vaccines now and more coming online. We are, I mean, not just in this country, we are vaccinating. It's a race between the virus and the vaccine, and we're not yet winning, but we can, as the Prime Minister said, see the beginning of the end of this. And I think that gives real serious grounds for optimism. And I think if you put those two together, I'm increasingly sure that this year, the world economy is actually going to be a really quite robust recovery, and much more robust than we thought. I think you're right that it's going to be K-shaped, and I'll get into that in a minute. But if you just look at the two big economies of the world, well, we can talk about the UK, and I'm sure we will later, but the two big economies, China basically escaped remarkably unscathed. It was the only big economy that grew last year. It's essentially put COVID behind it and is growing apace. But the real change, I think, will come in the US, where it's sort of hard to kind of overestimate the degree of stimulus in the US. Just to some numbers, which we have in a piece this week, but I knew there'd been a lot of stimulus, but I was really struck by that the stimulus that Trump put in place, so with the first stimulus package at the beginning of last year and then the December one together, amounted to approximately 20% of pre-pandemic GDP. Joe Biden is now asking for another $1.9 trillion, which will put the total stimulus, if he gets all of that, and he won't get all of it, but he'll get some of it, 26% of GDP. And that is sort of mind-blowingly large fiscal stimulus. And when you have, you know, the jab winning over the virus, and the US economy starts roaring back to life, and it will do, because a lot of the pain in the US has been in sectors which have been hit by lockdown. There's huge pent-up demand. Savings rates have shot up. People have got money to spend, and they're going to spend it. And so I think we're going to see something akin to what we saw in the beginning of the Trump administration, when, remember, the US economy roared because of the tax cut. This time, I think it's going to come back really very strongly. And when the US economy is strong and the Chinese economy is strong, the world economy suddenly looks a much better place. Now, the UK is not in quite this position because, you know, despite all the money that we've been spending, it's half the scale of the US in terms of the share of the economy. But nonetheless, the kind of global picture, I think, will start by the middle of the year to look considerably more upbeat than it is now. But I think the real question then, and we'll talk about this no doubt further, is sort of what do we go to? And we're not going back to the economy before the pandemic. We're not going back to the status quo ex ante. This is going to be a new world. And I think it's a world where we have seen many of the big shifts of the early 21st century, particularly geopolitical shifts and the technological transformation, dramatically accelerated. So we've seen, you know, the way we live, the way we work, the way we communicate, we've seen change that we would have expected to take years has taken months. And that is going to require a kind of massive Schumpeterian adjustment, change in our economies. City centers are going to change. Lots of industries, you know, from the airline industry to the hospitality industry, they're going to be very, very different than they were. So that the countries that succeed most, I think, will be the countries that can kind of do that transformation most easily. And there, I hate to say it, but I think the US is again in a better position, because the US hasn't used furlough. It hasn't tied people to old jobs. Essentially, unemployment shot up. It's now coming down again. So I think you need that flexibility to do that. And so I would look to the US to do that pretty well. And then one last point is, I think our expectations of what government can do have changed. And I think the big debate will be about what should governments do and what do citizens expect governments to do. And I think in a post-pandemic world, people's expectations of what they expect the government to do are quite different than they were before. So the kinds of discussions that we've been having here about universal credit extension are just, I think, the beginning of a much broader debate about the change welfare state. I'm hearing an echo. Are you hearing it?
If anybody's got their mic on, just turn it off.
So I suspect it will be a bigger, more activist, more high-spending government, because and I'll close with this, the other big change will be that I think we will sort of collectively do much more to combat climate change, because one of the wake-up calls of the pandemic has been what really happens when something that is a, you know, low probability, high impact hits you, or what happens when something that you know is going to have high impact hits you. And so globally, I think there's a much greater focus on attacking climate change. That will require higher public investment too. There is going to be a lot of demands on the public purse. The magic money tree doesn't exist. I'm enough of an economist to believe that it absolutely doesn't exist. But the real question will be, when does inflation return, and how long can we behave as though there is a magic money tree? And the US will be able to do that much longer than we can here, will be my prediction. But basically, a completely different economy. But 2021, I think, will be much, much more upbeat than many are now thinking.
Thanks, Zanny. In the week of Blue Monday, that's certainly much more encouraging. Tony, when we were talking earlier in the week, you were talking about seeing it in real time. Do you want to talk
about that? First of all, thank you for having me. It's great to be here. If I'm the cause of the echo, as I have been today on some calls, then please shout, but you'll let me know, Craig. I think it's a very odd time when it comes to time frames, because I think we're at the start of a quarter, the start of a year, and the start of a decade, which, although isn't mathematically true, is pretty much true in reality. And I think it requires a different mindset for each, but they all start right now. So, you know, the quarter ahead is about COVID and a little bit of Brexit overhang. And if you're my members at the CBI, and I'm sure most of the businesses on this call, are grappling with things like workplace testing. And we are grappling as a country with a disconnect, I think, in timings between the government, who are supremely optimistic about a sort of February, March timeframe for the world feeling better, and most employers I speak to who think actually their workforce aren't going to be vaccinated to the second half of the year, the economy's not really going to reopen to the second half of the year, and demand's not going to come back to the second half of the year. So at the moment, I think in sort of business government discussion around COVID is around really timeframes and uncertainty and workplace testing as part of the mix. But of course, the vaccination is a game changer. Brexit is teething problems at the moment, although some stuff starting to come out, which were either unintended consequences or legal realizations, are actually perhaps more interesting commercial realities, where things are actually just commercially too tough, regardless of what the rules are. And so I think we need a watching brief on that too. In terms of the year ahead with a budget approaching, look, I think the big issue is what does the recovery look like? Like most traditional British recoveries, it's probably got a hell of a lot of consumer spending. And I agree with Zanny, when you look at household savings, that should really roar back. And it's already in the numbers, according to our forecast, got quite a lot of government spending. What it doesn't have a lot of is business investment. And I do think there's a real opportunity to get business investment on the move. Now, it's a serial area of underperformance for Britain. But after sort of 5 years of British business sort of coiled up like a spring because of Brexit, there is an opportunity, particularly if the government can set out some long-term priorities and incentivize business investment a bit more, that can bounce back. And if I think it is part of the mix, then I think the Chancellor can worry a little less about tax rises and massive government spending cuts because he's got business investment in the mix. Zanny and you have spoken about a year of global leadership. One of the things I get to do in my new job is to chair something called the B7, which is a month before the G7. And one of the themes that's coming up is whether or not, if we are living in a protectionist world, and hopefully that will change with Joe Biden, actually can business show a bit of a light and a bit of leadership on both international collaboration, where governments have failed, and we'll be looking at climate and digital policy and trade. And also when it comes to net zero, has business now shifted from being, you know, a decade of being convinced to a decade of race to the top? I certainly see, talking to businesses, people now see competitive advantage in net zero as opposed to something to be mitigated. And then just finally, the next decade. Look, my own view is, and Zanny and William will have been writing about this stuff for years, you know, Britain has serially underperformed in areas like productivity, skills, regional inequality, business investment. And here we have massive shocks like COVID, Brexit, and net zero. And I actually think we need to do something we've never really done before as a country, which is to have a genuine national economic vision and strategy that stretches for the next decade about how Britain is going to compete and win in the world. Now, we don't do that stuff very often. I think we've had 10 business secretaries, 4 chancellors, and a few industrial strategies in the last 3 or 4 years alone. But I do think now is a time where we actually need to take a point of view about Britain 2030 and start shooting for that together in unity. We don't usually write reports like that, and I'd like it to be more than a report. But surely now Britain has to engage in that kind of national exercise.
Tony, that's great. I think you're right. When somebody else is talking, that was brilliant and fascinating. William, about 10 months ago, we started these calls and you were on them, and you pointed out that coronavirus was accelerating trends. And that's been a theme that's run throughout calls about accelerating trends. What's your assessment now of where we've got to? You did highlight some very specific trends. Where do you think they are now?
Well, thanks, Craig, and hello, everybody listening to us. And yes, it was way back last April, I think, that I said this would be the great accelerator. And I listed 8 trends. I might just, in a few words, I might just describe those 8. Don't worry, it's not going to be an essay about each of them, because I would add 2 more to it. And I would just say a word expanding on 2 of those trends where we can see things more clearly than we could a year ago. The 8 things I said would be accelerated, the existing trends in the world accelerated by the COVID crisis were US-China tensions would be exacerbated. They certainly have been over the last year. That the Eurozone would have to make fundamental decisions about its future, which it has with a jointly financed COVID recovery fund, that oil producing countries would have to adapt more quickly to energy transition with reduced budgets, but trying to be more ambitious in their diversification. You can see some of that in the Gulf states. That the Pacific century would arrive more quickly, that the point at which more than half the world's GDP is from the Asia Pacific. We would accelerate away from that 50%, upwards of 50%. I think we'll find that's happened when the figures come in for 2020. that the boundaries between the state and the individual would be shifted with more state intervention in people's privacy and life, that attitudes to government debt would be fundamentally changed, with really the death of fiscal conservatism, even among British conservatives or German Christian Democrats, that inequality would be exacerbated, and that there would be a faster progress of innovation. I think all those things are happening. I'm going to come back to two of them, as I say, to expand on them. I would now add two more, the trends that are accelerated. One already mentioned, the possibility of progress on climate change. Obviously, President Biden's election, as Zanny has said, is a big factor in that. It might turn out the single most positive effect of the pandemic was the postponement of COP26 by a year, and whereas it would have been a real struggle to make it a success in 2020, it has a possibility of success in real possibility in 2021. The other trend, and it's a parochial one here in the UK, but important to us, is that Scottish independence, the drive and momentum towards Scottish independence, has been accelerated by the pandemic. And that we didn't actually expect at the beginning. We thought Brexit would have that effect, many of us, but not that the pandemic would. And the pandemic, I think, clearly has. Two things to expand on there. That's the China aspect and the innovation. 2021, I think, will bring three new dimensions to the US-China confrontation. The first is vaccine diplomacy. China intends to manufacture 3.5 billion doses of vaccine this year, maybe more. That's a lot more than they need in China. And that is going to be, a lot of that is going to be directed into Southeast Asia, into Latin America, part of a major new soft power effort by China, going alongside, of course, the financial muscle of the Belt and Road Initiative. Dozens of countries in the world will be very reluctant to criticize China in the light of that vaccine diplomacy. Second dimension, even though those countries will be reluctant, what's happened now is China is a lot less popular in Western countries, in Western democracies, from Australia to Sweden, a lot less popular. Those countries will be a bit readier to coordinate with the White House now, with the new White House, their strategy on China, to coordinate a bit more what they do on things like Huawei, so on. Third dimension, and this, by the way, sets the scene for more clashes between China and the West over technology and over specific flashpoints like Hong Kong and South China Sea. Third dimension is, in spite of that, both China and the US will now try to come to some framework of cooperation on climate change, and the beginnings of what is needed, which is some sense of partnership as well as rivalry, might be there. Final comments from me are expanding on one other subject. We can all see, and others have commented already, innovation is accelerated by the pandemic. It really is. It is, in the House of Lords, we have been voting remotely on our mobile phones. This would have taken about 100 years to agree, seriously, 100 years, I think, without the pandemic. But it's not just the pandemic. It is also the US-China rivalry, superpower rivalry, in world wars and the Cold War, accelerates innovation, because of the tremendous state effort that goes in with the private sector to get ahead of the competition of the superpower, of the competing superpower. Then on top of that, we have that something's about to happen, has never happened in the world before, governments mandating innovation, requiring innovation by law in order to have the energy transition on a vast scale. And then on top of that, it just so happens that we are at the convergence point of many new technologies, of information technology with biotechnology, of all the different, of the 3D printing with the 5G and everything else. And so, and virtual reality and you name it, it's coming together. And so the 2020s look likely to be a most exceptional period of innovation. This is good news and bad news. Some people will be big winners from that. Other people and companies will be very big losers from that. Inequality is going to be exacerbated. in most societies. We're seeing it quite dramatically in the pandemic. Governments are going to struggle to deal with that. And I think there's going to be an increasing expectation that businesses take part in trying to deal with that, in bringing people back into the workforce, not just their responsibility to their employees, but to future employees, to potential employees, to people who are not employees. And I think that might redefine to some extent the responsibilities of businesses over the next few years.
That was brilliant. You've all done a great job in setting out the parameters. Let's try and get a bit more specific in the question. Zanny and William, I'm going to come to you both first, because something you said, Zanny, about, you know, the relief that many have felt in the last couple of days with a new president, that kind of thing, and a sense that the international institutions are back and climate change on the agenda. I just wonder, to the extent, do we actually really think that the tide has gone out on populism and culture wars? And many businesses have felt in the center of that and found that very difficult. Or actually, in reality, is it just there still? It's just that somebody else is just in charge while it's going on. Zanny, let's start with you.
I think it depends a bit on where you are. I certainly don't think you can say for a second it's gone away in the United States. 75 million people voted for Donald Trump. The country's unbelievably divided. It hasn't been this divided for a very, very long time. And those culture wars and those broader divisions are very real. I think in Europe, possibly somewhat. But I think, for me, the interesting thing is whether you can, and I agreed with pretty much every one of William's, I guess they're now 10. You had 8 and you added 2 more, 10 big changes. I would just add one. I think you're absolutely right that the pandemic has accelerated this technological innovation. It has also exposed what were already the downsides of it, widening inequality, very dramatic widening inequality. The one thing I would add to that is that I think it's going to lead to a greater concentration in many industries, because it's going to be a winner-takes-all environment. If you've come through this and you've been successful, you're in a very good position to kind of retain and grow a dominant position. And that's, we've already seen that. Look at what's going on with the tech companies. And that combination of inequality and concentration is a very politically tricky one. And I think it's exactly what fuels the kind of populist anger, Craig, that many people have felt. And I think one real question is whether governments this time around, and Biden's is going to be clearly the kind of lodestar on this, can kind of reshape the role of the state in a way that's sustainable, but that does enough for the losers that they feel that they have a stake in the system. And, you know, it's early days. I mean, a knee-jerk kind of lurch to the left that the left of the Democratic Party wants would clearly not be the way to go about it. Can they craft something that is more interventionist, that will succeed in keeping sort of the populist anger at bay? It's going to be tough, because the economy is going to be more concentrated, more unequal, all the things that William laid out. So for that reason alone, I'm not prepared to say, you know, populism's over, or it's kind of, you know, it's had its day, because it's going to be a more unequal, more divided place where the winners are making out like bandits and the losers are really hit hard.
And William, would you say that populism culture wars has accelerated or decelerated?
Well, it's decelerated a bit in the crisis, or it's been overshadowed a bit in the crisis. You know, Donald Trump would, without this crisis, without the pandemic, he might easily have got re-elected. And populists across Europe have certainly taken a knock where competent governments have turned in a reasonable performance. You know, look at Germany as an example of that. But a big note of caution here, which is the lessons of history. After a great world crisis, you normally get a large part of the political reaction a few years later, particularly if it's a populist reaction. You know, look at the 1920s and how things developed in Europe several years after the First World War. Look at the global financial crisis and how we really saw some of the political reaction to the trends that developed after that in the middle of the last decade. With Brexit, with the election of Trump, with populist successes in Europe. And so we won't know the answer to this for a few years, but Zanny is quite right. Unless we get things right, we will have that revival of populism. Unless we manage this to have this wave of innovation that we've been talking about without dramatic increases in inequality, well, the populism is going to come back with a vengeance. So it's not dead yet by any means.
So I want to spend a bit of time with all of you on the economy, but I'll come to you, Tony, on this. When you read the financial pages and even the front pages, it can be incredibly confusing about, you know, we're in for a disaster, we're in the middle of a disaster, there's going to be a disaster. No, it's going to explode. There's a huge amount of dry powder in the economy. It's all going to be fantastic. So this idea of the K shape, which is, you know, some going down badly, others going up dramatically. Do you think that's right? And how does a government begin to sort of interact with business to make sure that they get the right policies given that?
Yeah, well, I think there's some interesting stuff happening. I think Zani's point about the UK and other governments cushioning the Schumpeterian response of creative destruction by having, you know, by essentially protecting the viability of the existing economy for the purposes of jobs. It's an interesting question as to what that does to innovation. I mean, I in my old job, I spent loads of times with SMEs. And SMEs did a huge amount of pivoting innovation. So I think there has been some innovation, but whether or not it's quite the creative destruction that you might see in previous recessions, I think that's a fair point. And are we going to have zombie firms who are slow growth? I think that is a question worth asking. I still think that actually, you know, I think the Chancellor's pretty optimistic. There's going to be high levels of corporate deposits and there's going to be high levels of household savings, and that's enough to have some growth. But I don't think it's guaranteed. And this point about inequality and innovation inequality, I think what it's actually going to do is it's going to force us to have a conversation about leveling up and what it really means. And at the moment, I think the government came into leveling up, thinking about it in infrastructure and public investment. You know, leveling up was more trains in the north agenda. Whereas, of course, in reality, what leveling up is going to have to mean is real wage growth coming from microeconomic and business sector success. And what that's going to need in Britain is something we've never really had before, which is internationally competitive regions. And that's something that the Germans, that the Canadians, that any federal country's usually been good at, but Britain hasn't. And so I think the only way you're going to see off the real divide in Britain, which is likely to be regional, it's likely to be a north-south divide. Not just, I get that there'll be winning sectors and losing sectors and so on, but you're going to see a big north-south issue again, is if we find ways to genuinely level up the economic competitiveness and growth agenda of businesses in the north and other parts of England than are at the southeast.
So briefly, and that's hard. So briefly, Tony, something that's being floated at the moment by the Treasury is that that you have corporation tax goes up quite significantly in a budget. And just explain where you stand on that.
Well, look, I think we, two things really. The first one is it feels like a really odd time to start raising business taxes when we haven't got recovery. And again, I think it comes back to the dissonance between, I think, the government working to a schedule that's February, March oriented, and everybody else thinking about an economy that's far later in the year, a recovery that's far later in the year. And then secondly, look, corporation tax is low. I'm not sure that we're internationally competitive across the piece on taxes. So I think our big concern is around business rates, actually, where we're incredibly uncompetitive. So I think the Chancellor needs to think about international competitiveness of the tax regime as a whole, and he needs to think about timing. I hope he'll give it a skip this budget, but there seems to be heavy briefing to the contrary. So who knows?
And Zani and William, how worried are you about the levels of debt that governments are taking on? Zani, let's start with you.
So I'm not worried in the short term. I mean, I don't see any sign of inflation on the horizon. You don't, financial markets don't see any sign of inflation on the horizon. And you can sustain this level of public borrowing. In fact, the interesting thing is our borrowing costs, as you know, have gone down even as the debt stock has surged because interest rates have plunged so much. You can do it as long as interest rates are low. And I think they will stay low for the moment. I think the real test will come, and it may well come this year, particularly in America, and particularly if there's the scale of stimulus that looks like it might come now, that we see a kind of sudden inflation surprise, that the markets get, and the question then is, do the markets get spooked and do long-term bond yields soar? And if they soar, does the whole conversation go back to the one we had, you know, a decade ago of, oh my goodness, we need some austerity? And do we then slip into premature austerity? So there's the kind of, that's for me a conversation that is going to dominate, you know, the second half of this year in a way that no one is thinking about. And I've been very, very sanguine about inflation for the last decade and was very against the scale of austerity we had. But right now, I'm a little unnerved by the fact that nobody thinks inflation can possibly ever be a problem. It's kind of no one's even thinking about it. And when no one's thinking about something, then I think you want to start worrying about those kind of things. So I'm it's not my kind of main case. I think it's still a, you know, an outlier risk, but the sheer scale of public spending increases coming on top of what we had last year that we're going to see in the US lead me to think that you could have an inflation uptick there, and that will set the stage for everybody else.
William, one of your accelerated trends was the, you know, basically the end of austerity and government is spending big. I mean, you were part of a government that was keen on austerity. What's changed, and do you feel okay about it now?
Well, a big thing has changed since 2010, yes, when I was in the government, which said we had to get the deficit under control, and we had our decade of austerity. The big thing is that the whole world, pretty much the whole world is in this, certainly the whole Western world, most of the emerging markets are in exactly the same situation. And there is, as Zani just said, that there's the prospect of very low interest rates for a very long time. So this, the stock of debt that we are accumulating at the moment at this record rate is not a debt we're going to pay off in our lifetime. We are just going to, countries like ours are just going to live with this very high debt. However, there's a difference between just living with that forever and having a higher deficit forever into the future. I do think governments will have to show that they can control the future expansion of that debt, that they have to bring deficits into some sort of sustainable form again. And since government spending is going to be permanently higher as a result of the pandemic, we will always be spending more on the health service than we would have spent without the pandemic in the future. Well, and on social care and things like that. Well, then there's going to have to be some higher taxes in that. Of course, the clever thing to do might be to redesign the tax system over the next decade to hit our zero carbon targets and to adapt to the digital world so that we're not into raising the taxes we're all familiar with, income tax and VAT. It's just an economy taxed in a largely different way. And I think that is something to look out for over the next decade.
Well, you've led us very nicely into the next big topic, which is getting quite a few questions coming through as well, is COP26. The expectation levels around this are extraordinary, and certainly it's a conversation that we're having with a lot of our clients all the time. Tony, what do you think about the level of business interest in this? Do you think it's going to deliver? Do you think it's going to meet the expectations? Is it going to drive progress?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a real sea change. I think, you know, the phrase we're probably going to use in our campaign work this year is a race to the top among business. And I've probably done about 100 business meetings in the last 6 weeks, and everybody wants to talk about it. And the very worst point they're at is how do I, you know, make sure I'm not caught out by this? But there's a lot of search for competitive advantage. Now, what I don't know that we've yet done a good enough job on, although the Committee for Climate Change report in December had a quick go, is really understanding the implications of our net zero targets for the sheer scale of change that the economy needs to deliver and therefore businesses need to deliver. I don't think we've quite yet calculated the cascade to understand how much change that's going to mean how quickly. But I do think that this race to the top will begin, and I think COP is a really good forcing device for that. I agree with William that its timing could not be better. And businesses are deeply, deeply interested in it now, but there's going to be huge decisions. You know, I was talking to the construction sector this week. You know, the decisions that they have to now confront that they can't put off any longer are huge. And I think that'll be the same across businesses. There's an appetite. Everybody gets it now. I think they get that it's going to be a race to the top. But there's some big decisions to come.
And Zani, for Biden White House, they clearly want to sort of get a big win in the first year. Do you think that they're really putting a lot of chips on this?
Yeah, I do. I think this is a really big priority. I think after that, the short-term priority is, you know, conquering the pandemic and the stimulus for the economy. But right behind it is what they're calling the Recovery Act, which is Build Back Better, which will be the climate change legislation. And it will be, you know, trying very hard. It'll be a lot of money for research and development, a lot of investment in green technology, a lot of money to kind of decarbonize the US economy. But for me, the interesting thing about COP, and I completely agree with William that it's fantastic for Britain that it was postponed for a year, are we going to grab this opportunity as a country? It's an enormous opportunity for the UK to kind of punch above its weight, to play, you know, the center stage that we want to have globally. I have to say, I'm not yet convinced we're going. I'm really worried we're going to blow it. And I'm worried we're going to blow it because for perfectly understandable reasons that the in-tray in number 10 is massive. There's tons of things going on, you know, not least, you know, conquering the pandemic. You know, these things take a lot, not just of diplomacy, but a lot of legwork, a lot of preparation. And I'm sure business is figuring out what it needs to do. But COP is not going to be a success unless the government makes it an absolute priority to make it a success and really focuses on it being a success. And, you know, you would know better than me, but I'm less confident about that than I would like to be, because I think it's the best chance we have for global Britain and all that this year.
So William, it's pretty clear that Boris gets that this is an opportunity to sort of reestablish Britain on the global stage. But do you think that there is the detailed planning behind it? And COP21, there was evidence the French had been at it for many years before they actually got the Paris Accord. We're now, what, 10 months away?
I think there is. I think there's been a lot of focus on this in government over the last year. Of course, a government pretty distracted by the fact thousands of people are dying every day from the virus. So one has to allow for that. But I think so. It does have to be led at from the top of the government. Everything Zana just said is quite right about that. And my old friend Lauren Fabius, who chaired the 2015 COP, the successful Paris Accords, was the foreign minister of France at the time and really brought the full weight of the French state to bear in making it a success. So the government does have to do that. Alok Sharma will need the daily support of the foreign secretary, the prime minister, and so on when it gets near to the COP. Two things to add to this. One, it's still a very difficult exercise. You know, they will have in their in-tray on this things that say, well, there's all these problems with India, Australia is difficult, Brazil is completely opposed to a lot of the things that we want to do. So things saying, don't think just because the United States and China want to be helpful, this thing is now set fair. It is still going to be, it's going to be touch and go in the end, whether there is the necessary progress at the COP. But China and the United States, this is a very big factor. This is not now just China and the United States deciding whether they're going to cooperate on climate change. That huge global struggle that's getting underway that we were talking about between China and the US is turning into one in which each of them needs to lead on this subject, that it's part of their strategic competition to be the countries that are ahead in the technology and in setting the standards for a new age in energy. And so I think that may be the decisive tipping point here towards real progress on climate change.
So we're going to definitely come to China in a moment, but I'm just looking through the list of questions here and our old friend Brexit is popping up. Tony, we spent like 4 years ripping ourselves to shreds and business telling us that it was the end of the world and civilization, that this was going to happen. And yet we've been experiencing the reality of a deal for the last month. There have been teething problems and that kind of thing. Is it just because coronavirus is around that we're just, and it's masking a lot of the issues and problems, or is it actually going okay and we're surviving better than a lot of people thought we were?
Yeah, by the way, just one reminder on the last question, one observation I've made, and I've joined a lot of business leader calls with the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, and so on. Boris farms most questions away to the Cabinet, except for climate change. He is on top of the detail like no other issue I've seen him, as it happens. And I actually think, to Zani's hope, I actually think he's in really quite impressive shape. So I'm quite hopeful about that. Look, Brexit, where are we on Brexit? I noticed in the chat somebody sort of asked if it was more than teething problems. We have border teething problems at the moment. We have more significant problems when it comes to something like rules of origin and whether or not they're far too complicated for most small businesses in particular to take action. We've got some outstanding issues to resolve that are important, particularly in services, in particular, I think, around mutual recognition of professional qualifications, financial services, unsure. And I think it's just too early to know the commercial realities and whether or not they're changing trade flows. So you'll speak to various UK businesses who will say that actually they're losing custom or their supply chains are just not resilient. And it's not about the border and it's not about rules of origin. It's just about the cumulative effect of the transaction costs and the high ability for trade to go elsewhere. And so I think it's a bit early to judge it in its entirety. I think it does pose, and William and Zanny will be better than at this than me, it does pose a very interesting international trade role for the UK question. And what I can't quite work out now is whether or not we are becoming multilateralists, bilateralists, or something else altogether. And so I don't really know that I understand where the government are in terms of a views on international trade. But I think it's too early on Brexit to know, because what you're seeing now is the implications of some of the deals and their interpretations. What you're not quite seeing yet is whether or not actually the cumulative effect is to reduce trade or to reduce cross-border supply chains. Too soon to say.
Okay. I'm not going to make Zanny and William talk about Brexit, because I want to move on to China, which we touched on a bit about with climate change, and that's a positive thing. But a lot of people are worried about, you know, the acceleration of China to the top of, the superpower list. They're worried about, you know, how that's going to be for international relations. They're worried about impact of business, that kind of thing. Zanny, how nervous are you about their growing power?
So, look, I think, you know, China is the early 21st century's ascendant power, and we've got to get used to it. What is worrying for me is the combination not just of their, you know, growing clout and wealth, which other things equal, I would be totally fine with. It's that is happening at the same time as it is becoming a more authoritarian, more aggressive and rather nastier regime. And it's that combination that is particularly worrying. What worries me most of all, though, is the lack of strategic vision about how to handle the relationship between the 20th century's superpower and China. And, you know, Trump wrecked the old one, and rightly. You know, one of the few things that Trump really got right was understanding the threat posed by China. And I'm not sure I agreed with many of the ways that the Trump administration set about dealing with it. It would have been much better to work together with the allies. But nonetheless, there was a shift in the US position and US thinking about China, which was sort of long overdue, and is going to stay and is held exactly the same way by the Biden administration. The question is, as I think you raised at the beginning, William raised, that the ideal would be for the Western democracies, which would include the democracies of Asia as well, to work together in a way to be able to cooperate with China where there is mutual interest in doing so, and clearly climate is one of them, and kind of confront them and try and build a 21st century trade system that can deal with the fact that you do not trust this regime. And that involves, however, you know, these countries working together. And right now, actually, the thing that's most depressed me in the last few weeks has been that against the express wishes of the incoming Biden administration, the European Union went ahead and signed that bilateral investment deal with China, which showed incredibly powerfully that the West is not united against China. And, you know, there is, I don't think, any way of effectively, it's not combating China's rise, because China rightfully is returning to a place where, you know, we want it to be a wealthy country. It's got a huge number of people in it. It's not, I don't mind the rise itself, but it's figuring out a way to kind of handle this authoritarian, powerful regime. And it will only work if the West works together. And right now, the biggest culprits in signaling, at least, that that's not a priority are the Europeans.
So, William, you can feel this tension in the government this week, that you've got the pragmatists who say, look, you've got to deal with the reality of China. You've got to do deals with them. You've got to do business with them. A lot of businesses on this call will be doing that. And then you've got the CRG, who seem to have replaced the ERG as the biggest thorn in the Prime Minister's flesh, basically saying, look, there's a genocide going on in the country, and that they're torturing people and we can't allow this and we've got to stand up against this. How difficult is that for the government to resolve?
Well, it's very difficult because you really have to walk and chew gum at the same time here. And now, this is not unusual in complex relations between major powers in the world over history. At the height of the Cold War, we were often looking for ways of establishing frameworks of cooperation with the Soviet Union on arms control, on agreements about European security, and so on. So that's not an unusual thing in diplomacy. It's a tricky thing to explain, you know, that yes, we need to work with China on climate change, on biodiversity, on preventing future pandemics, on future arms control agreements, probably on stabilizing the world financial system in a future financial crisis. We're not going to be able to do any of those things without China. So you have to have some way of working with China and sufficient relations that you can do those things. On the other hand, we mustn't let ourselves be dependent on China. It would be very foolish for democratic free societies to let themselves be dependent on a totalitarian system for its technology, particularly in information technology. And so there are ways we have to say, well, we're becoming more distant. We are going to make sure we're not dependent in 30 years for all the batteries we need for electric vehicles on China. So that's now a national security consideration as well as an economic consideration. So it is quite a complex, you know, picture to describe. You have to hold two pillars of a policy in your mind at the same time. But I think both are necessary. And I imagine the Biden administration will be trying to construct both of those pillars of stopping Western dependence on China, but establishing some framework of cooperation.
Okay. That's going to be a big theme, isn't it, over the next year? And lots of people have spoken about how Biden has to appear domestically very, very tough on China as well. One of the things that's coming through a lot in the chat is the future of the UK, and lots of people are worried. We've seen that an acceleration towards, you know, the impact of mayoralties around the UK. England seems to be doing terribly well in terms of vaccinating people, Scotland and Wales less so. And of course, the big thing that people are concerned about is, are we actually going to see the breakup of the UK? How worrying is this as a theme that's developing and just getting in the way of people just doing business? Let's start with you on that, Tony.
Yeah, it's really complicated. I've done all the first ministers in the last 6 weeks as well. It's very complicated. And also, it's particularly complicated, by the way, for companies who operate seamlessly across these borders and still have essentially UK businesses, and they're incredibly anxious about it. Scotland, we'll have to see. I mean, my own view is that this time round, if we are in a referendum independence debate, then I personally think it should be lots of Scottish voices of Scottish businesses engaged in the argument rather than London voices. I think London voice, Nicola Sturgeon's done a very good job of discrediting London voices on anything. So I think that's quite frustrating, because of course you might want to make a case for, you know, economic cooperation and border openness and so on. But I think that will have to be Scottish businesses and Scottish voices if we get there. I do think there are some issues as well about, we may come onto a separate discussion about regional devolution in UK regions. But I think it is concerning, and you also see it with some of the Brexit issues as well with borders. You know, that GBNI supposed border thing is a real thing. So I think it's right to focus on it. I mean, look, it comes down to whether or not Boris Johnson has the courage and the stubbornness just to reject the referendum demand on the basis that actually it's not really a generation that's passed. And that seems to be his line, and that's for him. But I think business will be worried about it, because they've seen, as you say, the transaction costs of operating in jurisdictions within the UK. They are genuinely off-putting to trade, and they are not good for the economy. So I think you're right to raise it.
And Zanny, is this going to be something that's troubling the pages of The Economist much? Are you worried about this?
Yeah, I mean, clearly, as you said in your introduction, the pandemic has changed the terms of that debate. Interestingly, I think if you take a sort of longer term framework horizon and you look over the next decade, I still think it is much more likely that effectively, de facto, if not de jure, we have a unified Ireland before we have Scottish independence. Because I think the inexorable logic of economic integration is now sort of started there and is going to continue. So I think that's that. You know, I think it was a year ago we had a cover story kind of thinking that a united Ireland was much more likely than people were thinking, and I still think on a 10-year horizon that's to me the more probable one. But certainly politically, there's going to be a huge amount of discussion about Scotland, a huge amount of, you know, managing of expectations, and potentially, you know, potentially things could go the wrong way. Just one last point, though. I think that, you know, clearly we talk about the fracturing of the union and in negative terms, and rightly so in many ways. But the UK is still one of the most centralized countries in the world, and a bit of healthy devolution of tax and spending to the regions, the, you know, greater power to local and regional governments, I actually think would be no bad thing. I mean, this is an unbelievably centralized country.
William, it's supposed to be the Conservative and Unionist Party, but quite a lot of the new NTPs particularly give the impression that they're not really that fussed about whether or not Scotland breaks up or not. How big a worry is it for you?
It's a big worry. It was one of the main reasons I was against Brexit. Despite being a long-standing Eurosceptic, that I thought it would destabilize the UK itself if we left the EU. I think that is happening. Although, as I mentioned earlier, the pandemic has added a lot to this. An opinion pollster observed something to me yesterday that I found quite striking, which is that all over the world, governments' approval ratings in the pandemic have been pretty much correlated with how they've performed in terms of the deaths in their population, you know. So you get very high approval ratings for the government of New Zealand, for instance. Not so much for how things have been handled in many other countries, including our own, including the United States, so far. But the one exception to this is Scotland, where the performance in the pandemic is just the same as in England and Wales. But the approval ratings for the Scottish government handling it are very high and dramatically higher than for the UK government. So you have to hand it to Nicola Sturgeon, the way she has managed to present that while having just as many deaths in care homes and so on as in England. And my worry is that pro-union politicians in all parties, in Labour, Conservative, Liberal parties, haven't really worked out what the answer to that is. They are still groping, I think, for the right strategy to deal
William,
with in the coming months.
And William, I just wanted to deal with this in 30 seconds very quickly before we come to a final question for everyone. A few people asking about Keir Starmer. As objectively as you can be, how do you think he's doing? There was a cartoon in the Times the other day which was having him arrested for going out with nothing to say. Do you think he's struggling, or is he doing okay?
No, I think as someone who's been leader of the opposition, he's doing okay. You know, he's doing, if you compare his opening months to mine or Ian Duncan Smith or Ed Miliband or Jeremy Corbyn, you know, he's doing much better than we did in terms of people being receptive to what he is saying and establishing himself as someone who people might listen to in the future. But there is a long way to go. You know, don't underestimate the scale of the electoral mountain the Labour Party has to climb. And by the way, a bit very steep slope of that mountain is in Scotland. And without Scotland, the Labour Party is in a real mess.
It's very tough. Okay, we're coming to the end of the call. There's one thing I just wanted to sort of touch upon because I think it applies to business and something that you can all talk about. This idea of global Britain, you know, we're post-Brexit, post-coronavirus, when we get to post-coronavirus, is Britain going to be one of the countries that really is paid attention to on the global stage and can have a real impact and its businesses are out there and thriving and that kind of thing? Or have we actually really been demoted and we're not in the Premier League anymore, Zanny?
It depends on what we do. Depends on whether the government grasps this opportunity. I mean, we've done it before, right? 1945, 1979, we took a whole, essentially policies and big policy shifts shaped in Britain then became, you know, internationalized. And we were sort of ahead of the pack and everybody copied us. I think we have the potential to do that. We can figure out what a sort of 21st century, you know, market economy looks like, what the welfare state looks like, what the social contract looks like, how you do leveling up, all of these big questions which other countries face. You know, it depends on whether we actually do it. Right now, I don't think we have all the ingredients yet. We have the opportunity, but are we going to do it? You know, ask me in 5 years.
We'd certainly take you up on that. Tony.
Well, I'm optimistic only because Britain's had such a set of external shocks that I think it has shocked us into taking these issues seriously. I think we've been a bit complacent and sleepy about some of these things today. And I think now actually everybody is incredibly attentive to it. I really like Zenny's framing around 45 and 79. And actually the things we do ourselves as a beacon for broader economic developments around the world. I think net zero is the perfect example. I also think we could do it on things like diversity, inclusion, the modern world of work. But I don't think we'll do it if it's edicts from Downing Street, or we're waiting for the next thing from the Chancellor, or we're waiting for yet another industrial strategy. I think we'll only do it if we bring business and government together, and probably civil society, to develop a shared vision of the country. It sounds like a very non-British thing to do, but I think if we don't do it, then we're going to have it in smatterings, and that won't add up to enough.
And William.
I agree actually what the others have said, so I don't want to just say the same again, but yeah, the potential is that a country that has some of the world's top universities, including the top universities, and has the world's greatest, one of the world's greatest financial centers, perhaps the greatest, and has a critical mass in many fields of science, and is prepared to be open to new talent, which it does seem the government is prepared to be in its immigration policy, and has all the other cultural and linguistic and geographic advantages of the UK. But if we can't make a success of that, even outside the European Union, we wouldn't be very good. And I think we are good enough to do that.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. I thought that I'm certainly feeling a lot more optimistic and a lot more informed than I was at the beginning of the call. We always say that one of the downsides of doing these Zooms is that you can't show your appreciation with a round of applause, but I know that everybody will be giving you the usual virtual standing ovation. So Zanny Minton-Beddoes, Tony Danker, William Hague, thank you so much. You were all brilliant, really fascinating, and we really appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.